Chevrolet. You are an immigrant from Brazil. I am a gangster from America. Are you sure you want to play that game with me? I will do a home invasion on you. I will cut the power to your house, and the next thing you hear will be me climbing up your stairs in a pair of night vision goggles I bought in the back of Soldier of Fortune magazine. I'll pick the lock to the master room door, take a picture of you in bed with the Nogueira brothers working on your jiu-jitsu. I'll take said photograph, post it at www.dorksfrombrazil.com. Password, not required. Username, not required. That, Vandalay, is how you threaten somebody, dummy. Here's what all that needs to be done with Vandalay. It's as simple as this. Take a contract that says Vandalay versus Chael Sonnen and have him sign that with your cameras rolling. He won't do it.
Why not?
Because he's scared and he sucks. I was in Las Vegas when the Nogueira brothers first touched down in America. There was a bus that, this is a true story. There was a bus that pulled up to a red light, and little Nog tried to feed it a carrot while big Nog was petting it. He thought it was a horse. This really happened. Do you believe me that that happened?
Not really.
He tried to feed a bus a carrot. And now you're telling me that country has computers? I didn't know that. I did not know that.
That was Chael Sonnen in an interview with Ariel Helwani on the AOL website. And a fine man indeed. Chael Sonnen has had his share of issues that he has dealt with, suspensions and whatnot. And he will be fighting again in the UFC against Brian Stann, a military hero, on October 8th, I believe, at the UFC pay-per-view. And the thing that always strikes me about Chael Sonnen, even before I heard this interview, was how perfect he would fit into professional wrestling. And I think he's talked before about having influences, I think like Roddy Piper in wrestling. How perfect would a guy like Chael Sonnen be in wrestling? I'm not talking about scripted interviews. Just let him do what he does best, either as a wrestler or a manager. This guy is fit for pro wrestling. It's a shame he's not in it. He's also a liar, a cheat, and a con man, so he fits in perfectly. This is episode 167 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, July 10th, 2011. Sala Monster here. Hope everybody had a happy and safe 4th of July. I know I did, and because of that, I did not get to see Monday Night Raw, so there will be no usual good, bad, and ugly review. I did actually see the last segment. I just never went back to watch the rest of the show. And it didn't seem like anything of any great significance happened, although I guess Miz got some of his heat back finally on Alex Riley and beat the crap out of him. But you know, it was a taped show from the week before. I already knew pretty much what was going to happen. And the only noteworthy thing, I think, on the entire show was the storyline between John Cena and Vince McMahon anyway, and the fallout from the CM Punk stuff. By the way, with all the replays and all the talk about CM Punk this and CM Punk that, let this hopefully put to bed for anybody who still had any doubts whether or not this whole thing was a shoot or a work. I pretty much thought everybody already kind of knew, but we still have people asking questions. It was a work. A very well done work, but a work nonetheless. And as far as the segment goes with Vince and Cena, which again is the only thing I can really comment on, I liked it. I didn't love it. And the reason is the whole firing stipulation. You know, WWE has done this before, where they'll have a storyline or an angle or a match that people are really buzzing about or they're really looking forward to, and then they just can't help themselves. They have to tack on a stipulation. They did it with John Cena last year, which is a big part of why I don't like them going back to it now, where you have planted the seeds of doubt in a lot of people's minds, including members of the mainstream media, I might add. I mean, I knew Jim Rome was a schmuck anyway, but, you know, him thinking this whole CM Punk thing was real. And the thing about Jim Rome, who, by the way, is he has his own sports show. You know, he's an idiot. But the thing about Jim Rome is he's made it very clear before, I think. I don't listen to his show every day, but he's not a fan of pro wrestling. And, he's taken pot shots at it before. And my whole thing is this. If you're not a fan of wrestling, then don't talk about it. And he opted to go on the air and apparently was praising CM Punk's promo and invited him to come on the show, thinking the whole thing was real because he's an idiot. But the point is, they did a very good job, a very convincing job, of making people believe that CM Punk really did go out there, voice his displeasure with the company, and it's had the entire world talking. And so now you have a level of interest in this match at Money in the Bank next weekend with him and John Cena, where I really think this pay-per-view might not do all that badly. You know, a lot of their so-called B-level shows that they have, Money in the Bank is one of them. You know, these gimmick pay-per-views, they have not been doing very well. In fact, they've been doing progressively worse, to the point where I've argued before I would love to see them slash at least 3 or 4 pay-per-views off their schedule. I know we're never going to get back to the days of having just, you know, 5 or 6 events a year, but they definitely have too many pay-per-views. But it's hard to argue against it when most, if not all, of these shows typically at least break even, and more often than not, they not only break even, but they actually turn a profit. Now, they're not turning profits the way they used to, but if these shows are profitable, then why slash them? I get that. But they're already in a situation where some of these events may not be profitable. I don't remember if it was Extreme Rules or Over the Limit. I think it was Extreme Rules. But one of these shows, domestically, in this country, did something like 65,000 buys, whereas 75,000 is the break-even point. Now, I guess when you factor in the international buys, it was still a money-making show. But anyway, the point is, Money in the Bank should do pretty good. And I think all of that has to do with CM Punk and the intrigue that they've added to this match. And to me, I'm still looking forward to it, but to me, the minute that Vince McMahon threatened to fire John Cena if he allowed CM Punk to leave Chicago with the World Heavyweight Championship, it kind of took some of the edge off the match for me. Like I said before, in part because we just had a storyline less than a year ago. In fact, it was only about 8 or 9 months ago where John Cena was threatened with being fired. The whole Cena was kind of a slave to the Nexus, and I think it all culminated, if I remember, at Survivor Series. There was a Wade Barrett-Randy Orton match, and anyway, Orton won. Cena was, quote, fired. I don't think he missed a single episode of Raw when he was fired. I mean, they didn't even try to convince you that John Cena was really fired. He showed up every week. One week he had a ticket. The next week, the cameras are on him in the parking lot, and the WWE guys are beating up the Nexus guys. And of course, before long, Wade Barrett, the guy who said he would never reinstate John Cena, well, finally he backtracked, and he agreed to bring him back. The whole thing was a fucking joke, and it was really insulting. I mean, really, really insulting to you as a fan, if you actually gave a damn about any of that. And that was the last big hot storyline they had, was the whole Nexus thing last year before they fucked it all up. Now, I'm not saying they fucked this one up, not yet. But by going back to the firing stipulation that nobody, I mean nobody, could possibly believe, this went from being something that was, quote, real or felt real to just another wrestling storyline. And I have no idea what they're going to do. You know, people have emailed me, oh, what's going to happen at Money in the Bank? And honestly, I mean, the two scenarios that I think are most likely are either John Cena simply goes over CM Punk clean as a sheet, beats him in Chicago, and, you know, they put the camera on Punk as he gets the long goodbye up the aisle, and that's it. They go with the most predictable finish possible. Or, if they don't do it that way, Punk actually wins, which to them would be a swerve, although most people are talking as though they expect Punk to win. And then one of the Money in the Bank winners, presumably somebody like an Alberto Del Rio, who already kind of earned himself a title opportunity this past Monday, which obviously was taken away from him when, by the end of the show, CM Punk, who had been suspended, was quickly reinstated. Somebody like Del Rio, even though he's a heel, comes down and beats Punk to win the championship, which then sets up the Cena-Del Rio match at SummerSlam, which has been talked about for months now. To me, those two scenarios are the most likely. I know a lot of people are getting very creative with what they think is going to happen, and again, I have no idea. I don't know what's going to happen, but as is the case with whether it's WWE, TNA, people, they let their imaginations run wild. I mean, let us not forget Sting in February. Everybody convinced themselves. Everybody thought for sure Sting was coming in to face The Undertaker. And the reality was, even though WWE did reach out to Sting and they came very close to a deal, the only reason they reached out to him was because everybody had their undies in a bunch thinking it was Sting. So WWE felt, huh, this guy is available. People are getting kind of excited. Let's reach out to him and see what his level of interest would be. Now, if Sting would have agreed to come in, I presume that they would have gone with Sting and The Undertaker. I don't know where that would have left Triple H. I imagine he would not have been very happy about that. But the point is, those videos in February were building to the return of The Undertaker. You know, when WWE and Vince McMahon conceptualized those videos, and Vince basically went to the production team and said, put together a bunch of videos to hype up the return of The Undertaker. And that's what they came up with. Nobody had Sting on their brain. And it's one of those things that, again, it just kind of took on a life of its own. And I think in some cases, people are kind of doing that with this match of Money in the Bank. And The only advice I would give is don't get your hopes up too much. I think if you set the bar somewhat low, you're less likely to be disappointed. If something really big happens, you'll come away from that pay-per-view thinking you just saw the greatest match of all time. But if you set your expectations too high, I think many of us have been burned before. I would just caution against that. But again, I have a level of interest in this show that I didn't think I was going to have. I had no intention at all of spending the $40 or $45, whatever the hell it is, on Money in the Bank, and they sold me. You know, that Punk promo and the fallout from it, not necessarily this promo last Monday, but I don't think they did anything to ruin it. I just wasn't a fan of them adding the firing stipulation, but they sold me on it. Now, of course, I find out a couple of days ago that I'm probably going to have to be working that night. I mean, I never work at all, except on the sound off, typically on Sundays, but with my job, I have a function to attend at 7 o'clock that evening. So I'm ordering the pay-per-view, even though I'm probably going to miss pretty much most of it. You know, my hope is that I'll be back in time for the main event. I was really looking forward to the actual Money in the Bank ladder matches. I'm sure I'll end up taping it, and then, you know, the replay of the pay-per-view goes on right after the live show ends, so I'll see everything anyway. But, you know, the whole act of seeing it live, it's just, you know, it makes it more fun, but apparently I won't be able to do that. But they sold me on the pay-per-view with that whole promo last week, and I know I'm not the only one who feels that way. So anyway, Cena, McMahon, I thought they were pretty good. You know, Cena was a little more serious than he usually is. I like to see him do that more often. Vince McMahon, I thought it was very interesting, him making the comment, obviously playing off Montreal, that he doesn't feel confident that John Cena can beat CM Punk since Punk beat him on Raw just a couple of weeks ago. I believe that was when R-Truth distracted him from the crowd. And he mentions that he doesn't want Punk taking his title to another wrestling organization. And I don't think people, I know some of you probably did, but I don't think enough people have talked about that one remark. It's almost like a landmark comment for Vince to make, whether, you know, it was scripted and what have you, but very rarely, if at all, do you hear anybody, let alone Vince McMahon himself, who makes all of these decrees about you can't say the word wrestling, and you can't do this, and you can't do that. And then when he says, when you hear the word wrestling, people are like, oh, see, it was all fake. You guys report shit that's not real. You don't know what you're talking about. No, Vince McMahon doesn't know what he's talking about. All of those news reports about the band terms and, you know, don't say belt, say title, which, by the way, when was the last time you heard somebody say belt on WWE television? The point is, Vince can get away with more than a lot of those people can. And I don't think this is the start of us hearing the word wrestling every single week. I think it was done because, much like Punk in his promo, again, it adds an element of realism to it. But Vince acknowledging the fact that there are other wrestling organizations out there. And you know, we've heard the Ring of Honor name mentioned on TV maybe twice. You know, Punk did, and then Matt Hardy did a couple of years ago when he made his big comeback and attacked Edge, and he was screaming about Ring of Honor, Ring of Honor. But I thought that was very, very interesting. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. You know, you have a certain segment of the WWE audience who are young enough who I honestly don't think they really know that there are other wrestling organizations out there aside from WWE. You know, as they get older, smartened up, they'll learn that. But I just thought that was very interesting. So on the whole, I thought it was good. It wasn't great. Obviously, it wasn't on the level of what Punk did the week before. But what is interesting is that apparently they're hyping a confrontation of sorts between Vince McMahon and CM Punk live on Raw in Boston this Monday, which I am very much looking forward to. And I don't foresee them doing anything on this show, I hope, that would make me turn around and change my mind about ordering the pay-per-view. But this is going to be a very pivotal week for WWE, because I think Punk's promo sold a lot more buys, but what they do this week on Raw is going to go a long way in predicting how well or not this show does. And it's not all, you know, that much unlike UFC, who really, you don't hear a whole lot of buzz about UFC shows until the week before, until a couple of days before. And I think WWE, it's kind of the same way, and they can really do a lot, you know, to sell this pay-per-view. Last year's Money in the Bank show, which I've seen since, but I didn't order live, I mean, those ladder matches were unbelievable. In fact, the whole card from top to bottom, not so much on paper going in, but looking back on it, was an excellent show. I mean, there was even, if I remember, a fantastic Rey Mysterio-Jack Swagger match. I think Cena was in a cage match against Sheamus, which was good. It wasn't great. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, this could turn out to be an even better show than that. And I'm very curious to see what they do on television this week. Raw this past Monday got a 2.4. Not a big deal. It was. Here's the thing. I see people saying, well, they got a 2.4 because it's taped. You see, and this is why they can't do tape shows. No, it didn't get a 2.4 because it was taped. It got a 2.4 because in this country it was July 4th. And very few people, myself included, gave much of a rat's ass, quite frankly, about watching Raw. Or they DVR'd it. You know, I'd be very curious to see what the DVR numbers are. You know, maybe those numbers add another 10%, so we find out that Raw, in actuality, didn't get a 2.4, but they actually got a 2.8 or a 2.9. This usually happens. I don't know if the number is usually this low, but I think the last time Raw fell on July 4th, in fact, I'm positive Raw fell on July 4th. I just don't know if it was the last time. Ironically, was the night that Shawn Michaels super kicked Hulk Hogan in the face and went heel for about a month. That was back in 2005. I remember watching that show. That was another July 4th show. And you would think Shawn Michaels and Hulk Hogan teaming up in the main event against Kurt Angle and Carlito, that's got to pop a big rating. And again, it's July 4th. I think the rating just dropped like a rock. So I put no stock in those numbers at all when it comes to that. But for the people who think the fact that the show is taped is why it got a 2.4, that's not the reason why. In fact, if this was not July 4th and the show is taped, I'm almost positive that if the rating were lower, it probably would have been lower by maybe another 0.2, 0.3 at the most. People like to think that it makes a difference. It really doesn't. They will do tape Raws every now and then when they have an international tour and they have to double up on tapings in one night. More often than not, it has virtually no impact whatsoever on the rating. You have to keep in mind here that a lot of internet fans will still watch the show even if they can read the results online. Especially when you have a hot angle like this, a lot of people wanted to see for themselves what the follow-up was going to be. You can read it online or watch a YouTube video of it. But a lot of people still want to watch it live. But, you know, even if you take the internet audience into account, it's still a very small portion of their audience. I mean, I don't even know if, quite frankly, the usual audience on a Monday night, if you can even say that it's as high as 10%. I don't even think it's that high. I think people underestimate all the non-internet fans or you know, families or fathers who watch with their kids and whatnot, who don't know of any of that and, quite frankly, don't care about any of that. They're going to watch the show no matter what. What I did have a chance to watch this past week, pretty much almost the entire show, in fact, was Impact Wrestling on Spike. Now, I admit I had a somewhat selfish reason for wanting to watch the show. As you mentioned, as I mentioned last week, I was at the TNA house show in Brooklyn, New York at MCU Park last Friday and had a great time, aside from Ric Flair being a dick. It was a great show, and they said that they were shooting some footage for the TV show because they had two Bound for Glory tournament matches, I guess, for points, and so they were going to air highlights of that. And at one point, they had somebody scanning, just, you know, with this camera on a stick, going back and forth, taping the crowd and taping the people in the front row. We were in the front row, so I was almost positive we'd be on TV. And so I figured, okay, I'll watch the show so I could see my ugly mug on television. And I did make it on TV. I actually put a screen cap up that a friend of mine sent me because he was watching it also. And I was, in fact, not wearing a Spike TV shirt. That's the bug, the logo, in the corner of the screen. It looks like it's printed on my shirt, but it's not. So that was kind of cool. But I stuck around, and I watched almost the entire show. A few segments I missed, but for the most part, I watched more of Impact this week than I have in many, many weeks. And I came away from the show thinking, this was a good show. Hell is not frozen over. I actually said that. I thought Impact on Thursday overall was a good show. I thought that Impact had some really great wrestling on it. And that is one of the byproducts of the Destination X pay-per-view, which is actually airing tonight as I am recording this show. The TNA pay-per-view airs tonight. And I'm not ordering it, but for the people who are, I think you're going to be in for a really great show. I really do. They brought back a lot of old guys that competed in the X Division years ago in TNA, and in some cases, guys that have never competed in TNA but are well-known names on the indie circuit. Jack Evans, for example, I don't recall him ever wrestling on Impact before. Perhaps he did, but I certainly don't remember it. But bringing in all these guys, especially the smaller guys, and letting them just cut loose and do what they do best in that ring, and giving them some time for their matches. These are not 2 or 3 minute quick squashes. I mean, these are matches that have gone over 5 minutes, between 5-10 minutes or so, which is fine for television. I'm not expecting 15-minute matches every week, but just phenomenal stuff. And those matches have been taking place to build up to this pay-per-view. And I've said this before. Call me a cynic. Call me whatever you want. I am skeptical that this is going to continue next week, for example. I know they're building to a very big Impact show this upcoming Thursday. There's a big Impact taping coming up tomorrow. I believe that's when they're taping the Sting against Mr. Anderson title match. It's one of those Impacts they build up kind of like a pay-per-view. I'm sure, for example, tonight on the pay-per-view, they're going to be hyping the shit out of that TV show on Thursday. So maybe the week after. You know, my point is, I don't think that they're going to continue booking these kinds of matches every single week. If they do, great. I mean, that's one of those things that Impact could do that could very well, you know, make them turn the corner for a lot of fans. Because I think a lot of people would be willing to sit through the bullshit if they got great matches like they got this past Thursday every single week. People would still complain. I would still complain about certain aspects of it, but I think people would have less to complain about if that happened. And apparently I wasn't the only one checking out Impact on Thursday night. There were a bunch of WWE performers who actually tweeted about the show. Dolph Ziggler, the reigning U.S. champion, had this to say. He said, "Cool Ultimate X qualifier on Impact tonight. Jack Evans," he was referring to, "does some pretty sick stuff." And then the hashtag he put in there was, "See, wrestling can be fun." I don't think that's going to win him any fans behind the scenes. But that was kind of cool. Tyson Kidd also made a comment about seeing his friend Jack Evans back on TV. And Dolph tweeted again later. He said, "The X qualifier was fun to watch. And seeing Jerry Lynn and RVD in the ring together was also cool." I think Gail Kim may have tweeted about it as well. So I know, big shocker. You know, wrestling performers enjoy watching wrestling. But this was a good show. And just to go through some of the things that were on it, let me just get this out of the way first. Anything that involved Mr. Anderson on the show, I was not a fan of. And it's kind of funny because when Anderson was in WWE as Mr. Kennedy, and I'm pretty sure I talked about it on this show. I admit it. I don't hide from it. I thought he was the next big thing. I mean, I thought this guy's on the fast track to becoming a world champion, which he was. You know, I've told the story before. You've heard it elsewhere, I'm sure, that back in 2000, I guess 7 it would have been, I think is the year that Kennedy won the Money in the Bank ladder match. And Undertaker, of course, was really beat up. I think he had a torn bicep or tricep. He wrestled through it. He wrestled Batista at WrestleMania. I don't remember if he got hurt before that or it might have been after that, but he wrestled Batista again at the pay-per-view in April. And this all built up to May. I think it was there was a cage match on SmackDown where Undertaker and Batista, I think, went to a draw, and Undertaker retained the title. Then Mark Henry came out. This was one of those start-and-stop monster pushes for Mark Henry. And Mark Henry beat up the Undertaker, and then Edge came out to cash in Money in the Bank. Now, you might be asking yourself, why is Edge cashing in Money in the Bank if Mr. Kennedy won the briefcase that year? Reason being, Kennedy suffered an injury that they feared was a tear, I believe also in his bicep or tricep, and they felt they had to get the briefcase off of him. And so, on a random match on Raw, they put Edge in there with Mr. Kennedy, and I think Edge beat him within like 2 minutes. I mean, it was pathetic. And the match was for the briefcase. So Edge got the briefcase. They thought Kennedy was going to be out for a while. Didn't want to take a chance. And Edge ended up winning the championship from The Undertaker. And within a matter of days, or maybe a week, or whatever it was after that, Kennedy went back to the doctor and found out that he was misdiagnosed. It wasn't a tear. It was a really bad bone bruise. And he was only going to miss maybe a few weeks at most. And I know that he was really pissed. I mean, he was, to say he was angry about that would be just a tremendous understatement. And I could totally understand that. So Kennedy would have been the world champion then. And he missed his opportunity, and he never quite got back to that level. Kennedy got hurt a couple of times himself, so there were people who were worried that he was injury-prone. He put his foot in his mouth a lot. 2007 was the year of the Benoit murders, and a lot of WWE performers went on TV. Kennedy, there was a famous appearance. He went on, I forgot what show it was. It was on the Fox News channel. And basically lied. You know, they asked him if he had done steroids or performance-enhancing drugs before, which I believe later out it came out he did, or I think his name may have been wrapped up in that whole Signature Pharmacy scandal, and he would deny, and just the things that came out of his mouth really, really pissed people off backstage in WWE. He just made a clown of himself, and he really did not represent the company very well. So between him putting his foot in his mouth, constantly getting hurt, and then there was a fear that he was hurting other people. Of course, it all culminated. Kennedy actually had just come back from an injury, and it was the night that they did the big I think it was an 8-man tag in L.A. This was right after the whole Denver debacle, and Vince had his undies in a bunch about Stan Kroenke and the Denver Nuggets, and they screwed him out of the building. I'm not going to get into that whole thing again, but that was the night that the one team was wearing, I think, Lakers jerseys, and the other team was wearing Nuggets jerseys, and Kennedy came back, I think, in that match, and he was on the babyface team, if I remember correctly. And that was when he did a back suplex or something on Randy Orton. Orton had, you know, broken his collarbone two different times, and landed wrong, and he was just not happy about that. And Orton just tore him a new one backstage in front of everybody, just completely reamed Kennedy out in front of the locker room, and then went and complained to Vince McMahon and I guess other people, other main eventers, including John Cena supposedly, Shawn Michaels, possibly The Undertaker. They all complained, and Kennedy was fired shortly thereafter. So Kennedy never really came close to amounting to what I thought he was going to in WWE. I thought he was going to be a big deal. Then he went to TNA, and I knew that within a certain period of time he was going to be the champion, because that's how TNA operates. And, you know, the thing you could say about Kennedy is at least TNA put the title on somebody who was still relatively young and had a future ahead of them. It's not like he was a Scott Steiner who's past his prime, or a Booker T, and they brought, you know, a main event guy in and just put the belt on him. At least Kennedy is a younger guy, and they gave him a chance, and he has gotten over with a certain segment of the audience, so I can't fault them too much. But there's something about this guy now. I've done a complete 180 on him. He just annoys the shit out of me, and not in a good heel way, which is weird, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Anderson is supposed to be a babyface. Although I guess now that he's with Immortal, he's not. I don't know what's going on, and that's the problem with TNA. With the swerves and the turns and this and that, it's still, even though I don't watch the show every week, I keep up with it. I hear from people who do watch Impact every week and don't know what the fuck is going on. That annoys the crap out of me. But Kennedy, Anderson, whatever you want to call him, ain't doing it for me. I mean, even at the TNA house show that I went to last Friday, there were a lot of great matches on that show. He was in the main event in a non-title match against Kurt Angle. I will never, ever blame Kurt Angle for a bad match. And I can tell you that that main event was not a good match. And I put a lot of that on Kennedy. He's not a great performer. He's good. He's not great. Should he be the world champion? Well, probably not. Given the level of talent in TNA, I could think of a few other people that probably deserve to be in that position. You know, Samoa Joe, if they built him up right, I've said that before, he could be a monster. But the point is, Kennedy doesn't do it for me. So any segment he was in on the show, not a big fan of it. You know, the opening segment where Bully Ray was cutting a promo, Anderson Cump came out, whatever, it's the usual bullshit. By the end of the show, when they did what I presume may be another swerve, where, you know, Anderson apparently accepted an invitation into Immortal, and it wouldn't shock me if perhaps he really didn't join Immortal. I don't know where they're going with it, but I cared so little about this, it's not even worth mentioning. A couple of observations from the show. I mentioned this on Twitter, twitter.com/Solomonster, by the way, if you're not already following me. Bobby Roode reminds me so much of Triple H, it's almost scary. And I know other people who read that who said, I've been saying this for years. I never heard this from anybody. I'm not saying that those people are lying. It's not where I've heard this before, and now I saw it for myself. I just went into this, and I've seen Bobby Roode before, but just in this particular match, I'm watching him. And I'm really kind of studying him because I know TNA is very high on him. And they're high on Crimson as well, who beat him in a Bound for Glory match. But they really have high hopes for Bobby Roode as a single star. And I have no opinion one way or the other. I haven't really watched enough of his matches. Or at least I haven't seen enough of him as a singles performer. I've seen a lot of him as a tag team performer, and he's great. As a singles, though, it's a completely different ballgame. Maybe he'll be a big star, maybe not. You know, maybe he'll be the world champion someday. I'd probably take him over Mr. Anderson. But the way that his mannerisms in the ring, some of the moves that he uses, the way he I think what it is that puts it over the top for me is the way he tapes up his fists. It's exactly the way that Triple H does it. And I'm not saying he's copying off him, but with, you know, the shoulder length, long hair, the taped fists, some of the moves, his movements and mannerisms, very, very Triple H-like, which probably bodes well for him, quite frankly, although if he ever goes to WWE, it may not. But it really struck me watching Impact on Thursday. We had a three-way Destination X qualifier that included Tony Nese, an independent wrestler, Jesse Sorensen, another independent wrestler, and Jack Evans, also an independent wrestler, although he's also been wrestling a lot down in Mexico in AAA. I first saw Jack Evans years ago at a Ring of Honor show live, and even then, I mean, this is one talented guy. That goes without saying, and it was actually really nice. I think the outpouring of other wrestlers on Twitter mentioning Jack Evans and the fact that he was on Impact, he's got a lot of respect from a lot of people in wrestling. He does things in the ring that very few people can do. He's been doing it for a long time now, so you have other independent wrestlers who are coming up in the ranks who are probably doing things that are even more impressive, but Jack Evans in many ways set the standard for them. And, you know, he's a likable guy. He's almost perfect, I think, as a babyface. And he did some amazing things in this match. This match was the Jack Evans showcase. And he won the match. He qualified. He'll be at the Destination X pay-per-view, I would presume. To be honest with you, Sorensen and the other guy, too, I mean, they also were pretty impressive in this match. And what I liked about it was the pre-match footage that they showed. So they were showing footage from actual independent shows. And you know, for example, in one case, they had footage of one of the guys, and they gave, you know, a credit on the bottom of the screen to the NYWC, the New York Wrestling Connection, which I believe is run by Mikey Whipwreck. You know, and they're an indie that operates here in New York. I thought that was really cool, and again, it's the sort of thing you'll never, ever see on WWE. You know, for CM Punk can mention ROH and New Japan Pro Wrestling all he wants to, but never in a million years are you going to see footage, for example, from a Ring of Honor show on Monday Night Raw. You know, it's just not going to happen. So I thought that was a nice added touch. One of those things that TNA does and can get away with, that Vince McMahon is, you know, he has this closed-minded view of what wrestling is and rarely will ever acknowledge the fact that it even exists. I mean, he won't even acknowledge the fact that he runs a wrestling company, for crying out loud. So that's one of the things I really liked about this. Rob Van Dam won a Fatal 4-Way match that also involved Jerry Lynn, AJ Styles, and Christopher Daniels. The only thing I didn't like about this was the fact they put RVD and Jerry Lynn together in the ring. If it were a tag match, let's say, which is exactly what WWE would have done. If this were WWE, it would have been AJ Styles teaming up with his opponent, Christopher Daniels, his opponent at the pay-per-view against RVD and Lynn. And in this case, I actually would have preferred that. I think it would have been a hell of a match, but I don't think RVD and Jerry Lynn have been in the ring together in over a decade. And this was the main event that TNA wanted at their Hardcore Justice pay-per-view last summer. Because RVD and Lynn had a string of just phenomenal matches in the old ECW. In some ways, it's almost like the Flair Steamboat of this generation. In that Flair and Steamboat had this string of two or three amazing matches, and they had many more matches than that in their career. But back in '89, they had that series of matches that I still remember today as being among the greatest matches of all time. And I'm not saying the Lynn-RVD matches are the best ever, but in many ways, it's kind of similar to that. And these guys have not been on opposite sides of the ring, like I said, I think, in over a decade. And you tried to build the match for the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view last year. I think they even announced it. Jerry Lynn got hurt, suffered a really bad back injury that he had surgery on. So for all I know, this may have been Jerry Lynn's first match, officially, since his back surgery. I'm not sure about that. But you put these guys together, now you're hyping a match between them at Destination X, and, you know, the week before, not even the week, 3 days, 4 days before, you put them in the same match, and they actually did wrestle a little bit in this match. I don't know that it's going to stop people necessarily from ordering the pay-per-view, but again, it took a little bit of the edge off. I think part of the allure was here are these two great guys who have not set foot in the ring one-on-one, face-to-face in so many years, buy the pay-per-view, watch them tear the house down, and you put them in the same match on Impact 3 days before. I don't get that. I thought that was really dumb, but having said that, it was a nice match. RVD kind of turned the Jets on. To me, for the longest time in TNA, RVD is just, he's just been resting on his laurels, in my opinion. Either that or he's just getting older, which he is. And maybe he's lost a step or two. Because RVD can still go in there and wow the crowd. And I just haven't gotten that in the matches of his that I've seen in the last couple of months. Here it looked like he kind of turned the jets on a little bit. I think at the pay-per-view tonight, you're probably going to see a hell of a match. I don't think it's going to come close to the matches they had all those years ago in ECW. But I think if you order Destination X, you're probably in for a wild ride with these two guys. And RVD went over in this match. I believe he got the pin on Christopher Daniels. I could be wrong about that. And good stuff here. The sight of Hulk Hogan beating up Sting backstage with a baseball bat, I let out a hearty belly laugh at that. There's not much Hogan can do. Even when he does stuff like that, it looks so light and so fake. He just seems so fragile. You know, he keeps himself in great shape. He's got arms that even I'm jealous of, but the guy can't move. He can't do much. So when I see him beating somebody else up, even with a weapon, it's hard. It's very hard to suspend your disbelief. And Sting, you know, again, I've said before, I'm really a big fan of this new Joker Sting, which now with the makeup is a blatant, direct, exact copy of Heath Ledger's Joker from The Dark Knight. But I'm okay with that, because I think Sting, it adds a very intriguing element to Sting's character. It freshens him up a little bit at a point where Sting is 52 years old. And if he's going to stick around for a little while longer, it's good that he's trying something different. The problem is, and again, I said this earlier, I don't know, for example, if Mr. Anderson is supposed to be a heel or supposed to be a babyface. I guess now he's a heel. But those things are not entirely clear. Sting, I presume, is a babyface. But the way that he's been acting on Impact would lead one to believe, for example, if you were tuning into the show for the first time, he looks like a villain. And Hulk Hogan comes off as the babyface. Now, I know Hogan kind of spoiled, I guess, future TNA plans. He did this interview with at the EA convention hyping his own video game, which is separate from TNA. I guess Hogan has a clause in his contract that allows him to do stuff like that, independent of TNA. And basically suggested that in the near future we may be seeing a return to the red and yellow, brother. And that was kind of dumb for him to do if he indeed did spoil TNA's plans. But right now, Hogan's the heel and Sting is the babyface. And in many of those segments between the two of them, it seems like the complete opposite. So, again, not a big fan of that. But, you know, the main event was a handicap match. Bully Ray, Scott Steiner, Abyss, and Gunner against Kurt Angle in a handicap match. Sting never did come out since, again, he was beaten up by Hulk Hogan. And this, you know, degenerated. There was Mr. Anderson's interference and again, threatened going after Immortal. He ended up joining them. Who really cares? But I cannot really say too much negative about the show. What I watched, I really enjoyed Jack Evans. It was the Jack Evans show on Thursday night. Hopefully, you know, he'll win his match at the pay-per-view. And the only problem is, you know, if Jack Evans, for example, does go to TNA and is on TV every week, it probably won't take that long before Jack Evans is just another guy. I just, you know, he's small enough where I just find it hard to believe that, you know, Hogan and Bischoff and even Russo and all those guys are going to really do much with him. But for now, good for him. You know, he's on network television doing his thing, exposing himself to an even bigger audience. Even if he doesn't go to TNA, more people probably saw Jack Evans than ever before. And hopefully it ups his value a little bit. He deserves it. He's a hell of an athlete. But yeah, thumbs up on Impact this week. Some other quick news bits here. Former WWE writer Court Bauer apparently tweeted either earlier today or yesterday that there was a big change within the creative team on the SmackDown side of things in WWE. Apparently Ed Koski, who has been a writer for some time, and I think he was also assigned to write for the ECW brand before it got folded, has apparently replaced Michael Hayes as the lead reader, or writer, I should say, reader, on SmackDown. Michael Hayes is not fired. He's not leaving the company. Apparently he's taking over some other responsibilities, overseeing some of the other production people and whatnot within WWE. But yeah, it should be interesting to see if there's any sort of change in the on-air product on SmackDown. If I remember, Ed Koski might have been a protege of sorts under Paul Heyman, if I'm remembering correctly, during the days of the SmackDown 6 and all that, when you had all those great matches, and SmackDown was, maybe not officially, but arguably was the A brand back in like that 2002 to 2003, 2004 period. So who knows? Maybe this is a positive change. The other thing, which I thought was kind of interesting, and I had to mention it here, there was a tweet sent out on Tuesday by Charlie Sheen, who has a couple of million people following him on Twitter. And it said, heading to the Insane Clown Posse's 12th annual Gathering of the Juggalos on August 13th. Why? Because I'm down with the clown. That's what Charlie Sheen said. And apparently, he will be the MC at the upcoming Gathering of the Juggalos, which it's basically this hybrid mix of concerts and pro wrestling. Because, again, ICP, they're musicians. They've been huge wrestling fans. They've done a lot of wrestling. They have their own, I think, JCW, Juggalo Championship Wrestling. They put on their own iPay-per-view shows, I think, each month now. And so this was all over TMZ. And apparently, you know, you would think, well, how could they afford somebody like Charlie Sheen? But apparently it was Sheen's people who called them a couple of months ago about doing this, because Charlie Sheen just had to be part of this when he learned about it. And they said they were willing to work with them as far as coming to an agreeable fee for the show. And apparently they came to a reasonable price, and Charlie Sheen is going to be there. And that should be very, very interesting. There's a Dutch Mantel has a book out. I think he might have two books now, but I think it was his first one. And he posted a chapter from the book a while back on his website. I think it was a website devoted to plugging the book, and he posted a chapter from it. And this chapter described his experience, I think either last year or the year before that, going to the Gathering of the Juggalos. And you've got to track this chapter down, or just buy the book and read about it, because it's incredible that something like this even exists. It's one of those things that it sounds so wild, you feel like you've got to be part of it, but when you read about what Dutch had to go through just to find the area where this was being held, I mean, it's not in a building. I mean, it's basically in the middle of nowhere, just in the middle of bumblefuck USA, and you've got tents, and you've got these makeshift whatever set up, and just people, I'd say people from all walks of life, and I don't mean this in a negative way necessarily, but freaks from all over the country just converge on this one place because, you know, they all share a love of either pro wrestling or ICP's music, and they just come out of the woodwork, literally out of the woods. It's in the middle of nowhere. And no communication. I'm sure cell phones probably don't work out there. You're in pitch black darkness. You've got to track down that chapter or just buy Dutch's book and read about it. And I don't know if Charlie Sheen quite knows what he's in for, but it should be interesting. I recall finding a clip on YouTube a couple of months ago of Kamala, who apparently appeared at one of the gatherings. And you know, you don't go to these shows expecting a Matt classic. You go there, they have matches and stuff. I think Terry Funk has been there before and all that. Dusty Rhodes may have been there, if I remember correctly. But a lot of weird things happen. And in this clip, Kamala, it's like pre-match, and they're trying to get him to smoke a joint. And it's actually quite comical. And then Kamala actually smokes a blunt on camera. Or somebody was taping this with their cell phone. So if you want to track that clip down, that would be kind of interesting. So I hope there's footage of Charlie Sheen at this thing, because I'm very curious to see how this turns out. And speaking of clips, I have to mention this here. I haven't posted it yet, but by the time you listen to the show, I'm sure it'll be up. I'm going to post it on Twitter and Facebook. So go to twitter.com/Solomonster, follow me on there, and go friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. I'm going to post a clip to a YouTube video. It's under the channel by Daddy Doyle Studios, all one word. And I think it's the same person who posted a couple of months ago this hilarious video. It's basically footage of the night that Hogan turned heel in WCW and hooked up with Hall and Nash. It was the Bash at the Beach. And the guy transposed onto Hogan, Hall, and Nash's bodies the faces of LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and I think Chris Bosh of the Miami Heat. And it's hilarious. So you can find that video. But this video that I just watched earlier, I laughed my ass off at this video. I'm going to post it on Twitter and Facebook. It's titled LeBron James Lashes Out at Miami Heat. And the ironic thing about this, let me check here when this video was up. This video was uploaded last month. It's just ironic because I was talking about this segment last week on the Sound Off, so it's a little eerie here, but he took footage from Raw back in 1997 of the night that Bret Hart snapped after his cage match and went on that rant. I played some audio from it last week, and he puts LeBron James's head on Bret Hart's body, and he also takes Dwayne Wade's face and puts it on Steve Austin's body. He takes Chris Bosh's face and he puts that on, I think, not Undertaker, somebody else's body, I don't remember who, and he takes Dirk Nowitzki's head and puts it on Psycho Sid's body. And there's a couple of other, like, you know, David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA, is, like, one of the referees. And Pat Patterson, who you may recall, I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but Pat Patterson kind of made an appearance during that whole melee trying to break it up and get struck. And, you know, they put Charles Barkley's head on him. And you listen to the commentary. It's just fucking hilarious. I don't see how anybody could watch this video and not like it. So, just very well done. Go watch it. I didn't think that it was possible to take one of my all-time favorite Raw segments and make it even better, but I think this guy did it. So go online and check that out. Let me know what you think. So before I get into the mailbag here, I want to give a quick heads up, a thank you to Brian from my page on Facebook, who alerted me to the fact that I completely forgot about that yesterday, as I record this, yesterday was July 9th. Was the 10-year anniversary of the night that the WCW-ECW alliance was formed on Raw is War. And I've discussed this before. I cannot think of another Raw episode. I'm sure there's been some. But it's hard for me to think of another show that started out and kind of unfolded with such promise and got people so excited. And by the end of the night, had people so pissed off and disheartened. I know some people actually liked the fact that they merged the WCW guys with the ECW guys. They actually liked the alliance. And, you know, for as boring as wrestling can sometimes be in 2011, even I will look back sometimes on the invasion in 2001 and have some nostalgic feelings. But I've pretty much maintained my opinion throughout that that is the all-time most botched angle. I mean, they squandered millions and millions of dollars. And if you think it was good, it could have been better. And it's hard to let that go because they had such an opportunity. They could have turned something negative, which was the death of WCW and ECW. And for a lot of reasons, it was actually a plus that WCW went out of business because of the idiots that were running it into the ground. But the idea that the second biggest wrestling company, and by default, the third biggest wrestling company in the country, if not the world, died within, I think, 2 months of each other. You look back on it now in the wrestling landscape and the way things are and the way things used to be, it was a huge negative. And they had the opportunity to turn it into a huge positive. And they did for one pay-per-view. You know, the Invasion show in July of 01, 10 years ago this month, did, I think, what is to this day the biggest buy rate of any non-WrestleMania pay-per-view ever. Ever. And, Boy, did they fuck that angle up. But I remember that Raw episode like it was last month. I mean, there was a match, I believe it was a tag team match. It was Chris Jericho and Kane against Lance Storm, and I cannot remember who the other person was. But Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam ran in. They made their WWF debuts in this match. They ran in, they interfered. And then, within a matter of moments, you had Taz, you had Raven, you had the Dudley Boys, I think Mike Awesome, maybe a few other people. They all ran down. They were all WWF guys. But obviously, when you looked at them standing in the ring, you realized it's one of those things where it doesn't hit you at first, and then you give it a few seconds, and you're looking at this, and you say to yourself, holy shit, something bad is about to go down. And all of these guys who used to be ECW guys, and you slowly realize that, holy shit, Taz used to be an ECW guy, Lance Storm, Dudley's, and they all turn around at the same time, and they attack Chris Jericho, and they attack Kane, and it's one of those segments that illustrates why Jim Ross is the greatest wrestling announcer that ever lived. All due respect to Gordon Solie and all those guys, there has never been a better announcer than Jim Ross, and it's because of situations like this. You listen to him do commentary on this, it's just phenomenal stuff. And imagine that segment, for example, with Michael Cole on commentary. I don't think it would have been quite the same. And then Paul Heyman, who was doing announcing at the time, climbs into the ring and cuts this, again, work shoot promo. We were talking about work shoots last week. And just runs down the WWE, runs down WCW, which was a swerve, because, again, they all united at the very end of the show. And when they went to commercial break and they played the ECW theme and they went to commercial, I thought to myself, holy shit, that was awesome. And you fast forward to the end of Raw that night when the WCW guys and the ECW guys united. You know, they had the potential to do kind of a three-way feud where the ECW guys would be rebels all unto themselves. They'd come through the crowd maybe on some weeks and beat up the WWE guys and the WCW guys. But they put them together. And I didn't agree with that, but what really made this segment so horrible and so difficult to swallow was the very end when Vince McMahon is standing on stage and Paul Heyman is in the ring and Shane McMahon, you know, the owner of WCW, is in the ring, hand in hand, arm in arm. And then Stephanie McMahon is introduced as the new owner of ECW. And Stephanie was looking mighty fine that night, I must say that. In fact, every time she would come out wearing one of those ECW berets, she looked quite good. But just the notion of Stephanie McMahon and Shane McMahon, two McMahons, of course, standing there as the heads of WCW and ECW, and there's Paul Heyman in the background. It's just such complete bullshit. And, you know, if you like that segment, then, hey, more power to you. But more people hated that segment than liked it, and that was one of the big reasons why. And I'd like to look back on that night. I could have looked back on that night as a landmark night in wrestling. And it still was a landmark night, but just for all the wrong reasons. It just brought back so many horrible memories of what might have been. And that was 10 years ago this weekend. Hard to believe. Let's break into the mailbag here. Just a quick word here to one of our listeners, Rick Malloy. If you are Rick Malloy, you might want to check your email address because it's sending spam emails out. And I've had to block you, unfortunately. So if you are unaware of that, and hopefully you are, and are not doing it on purpose, you need to get that fixed or start sending emails under a different email address because it has been invaded by evil forces. So I just wanted to make him aware of that if he was not. Mark writes into the show, Dear Solid Monster, number one, if you could create a faction comprised of any current WWE wrestlers, excuse me, entertainers, who would you pick? Also, why didn't you play CM Punk's promo in its entirety last week? Because all other podcasts I listened to did. Well, good for them. I'm not going to sit here and play a 6-minute promo during my show. If people, believe me, that's a promo that everybody listening to the show heard. In fact, I'm sure they went back and they watched it 5 or 6 more times like I did. You know, let other wrestling podcasts do that. I knew they would anyway, which is why I didn't do it here. So if you like them a lot better, good, listen to them. Don't listen to mine. As far as the faction question, I think CM Punk brought it up during his promo, first time on WWE television that somebody really acknowledged it. I think the idea, you know, they had USA versus Canada as a big storyline in 1997, and they had like two huge factions of fans kind of warring with one another. I don't think it would quite be on the same level, but I think having something like an entertainers, you know, your typical WWE superstars against wrestlers feud. And if the wrestlers were led by CM Punk, who could get the job done as a faction leader, you know, and he has maybe somebody like a Daniel Bryan in his faction, and let's just say for argument's sake, the Kings of Wrestling, Chris Hero and Claudio Castagnoli from Ring of Honor, do sign contracts that they have been offered with WWE, and you bring them in, have them as part of the faction, and pick one or two others at the most. I wouldn't have more than that. One or two other guys currently on the roster, good in-ring performers who just need a little bit of help. And having somebody like CM Punk as their mouthpiece, as part of a faction, they can get the rub from some other guys that can help put them over the top. I would love to see something like that. I think that has a lot of potential to it. Stephen M. writes in, Dear Solid Monster, who is better lyrically on the microphone, Steve Austin or The Rock? I understand they both can make you laugh, piss you off, and they can be serious, but when the smoke clears, who is number one? And as I said to Steve in a direct email, my vote would probably be with The Rock, but it's like asking which testicle I like the most. You know, I love them equally, and I cannot bear the thought of being without either one of them. It's probably the best answer I could give. Mir from Chicago writes in, Hey Monster, thanks for mentioning my email on episode 165 last week. I'm going to be at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view on July 17th. I'm still debating whether I should hold a Solid Monster sign or a Zack Ryder sign. Well, bring a Solid Monster sign. There's going to be plenty of Zack Ryder signs there anyway. Plus, at least they won't take yours away. Lawrence from New Jersey sent me an email. This goes to something I mentioned last week. I got a question from somebody asking me about the angle with Eddie Guerrero passing out on SmackDown, and I mentioned that I had absolutely no recollection of this whatsoever. And Lawrence was kind enough to send me a link to a match from the May 20th, 2004 edition of SmackDown. And it has the angle where Eddie passes out. Apparently, it was a six-man tag team match, Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, and RVD against JBL and the Dudley Boys. So it did happen at least once. It probably happened more than that. And I honestly just didn't remember it. I probably saw the match, but it just wasn't one of those things that stuck with me. It's like if you ask people, hey, do you remember the Randy Orton concussion angle? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this show probably remember it, but it's one of those things. They did it for a couple of months, and then they just kind of dropped it. You remember, there was a period of time in like late 04, early 05, when he went babyface and was feuding with Triple H, where... And they would never do a storyline like this now, obviously. But back then, it was fair game, where Randy Orton was suffering concussion after concussion. He had post-concussion syndrome. They let him wrestle. What a bunch of douchebags. And I think, actually, if him and Triple H, if I remember correctly, they had, I think, a last-man-standing match at the 2005... Would have been, I guess, the 2005 Royal Rumble. Triple H won, and the camera would zoom in on Orton, who his eyes were wide open, and he had this glassy-eyed look on his face, like he had suffered another concussion. And apparently he, I guess, was cured of his post-concussion syndrome, since they never referenced it again, and he never got that glassy-eyed look again. Although Orton did admit in that radio interview that created such a buzz last week when he was yakking with the radio show hosts, that he suffered at least half a dozen concussions, and the one that he suffered recently in Spain was actually a pretty serious one. And yet, he was wrestling a pay-per-view match against Christian 1 week later. Thought that was kind of interesting. Trust writes in, Dear Solomoser, has being a WWE superstar lost its luster? There have been a lot of guys, Chavo Guerrero being one of them, MVP, the Hardys, Low Key, etc., who soon after their releases comment on being happy getting away from WWE. And you have people like Batista who say they've lost faith in the product. What do you think of this? That's from Trust, who's been a fan of the podcast since the episodes in the 140s. And this is a great question. And it's not the first time I've gotten this question. But with Chavo supposedly requesting his own release, going on Twitter, commenting about how much happier he is. Now he's already appearing, you know, taking independent bookings. I think he's appearing in Mexico sometime in the next couple of weeks. MVP, let go. I don't remember if he was fired. I think he also requested his release. He was unhappy for a long time. He had a lot of heat backstage. For the longest time, he just couldn't seem to shake it. And MVP, much like Kennedy, is another one of those guys who I think had great potential in WWE, perhaps one day as a world champion, and left the company, and he is much happier since then. You know, one of MVP's great dreams was being able to go to Japan, which I think for the longest time was a problem for him because he had a criminal record. You know, again, he served 9 years in prison. And I think only recently, maybe in the last year or so, he got those issues resolved. He went to Japan, and he's actually an intercontinental champion right now for one of the Japanese organizations. He's living the dream. He's wanted to compete there and be successful in Japan for his entire life. At least his entire wrestling life, since he became an active wrestler. And, I mean, he would study tapes of Masahiro Chono, and you could see it in his old WWE matches. He tried to incorporate more of the Japanese style into his matches. So, yeah, he's a lot happier now than he was before. Low Key has talked about the fact, you know, I'm a wrestler, I'm not an entertainer. And, you know, he admitted that he was fired. He did not, in fact, ask for his release. He was fired right around Christmas time. So, way to go, WWE. But here's the deal with this. And CM Punk is another great example. You know, Colt Cabana did an interview with the Miami Herald right after Punk's promo. And one of the things that he stated in the interview, which is complete shoot, is that Punk realized being a WWE superstar, which was something he wanted to do his entire life. Okay, here's a guy who grew up a wrestling fan. There's a great picture. Somebody posted it. I've seen it before, but they posted it on my Facebook page. A couple of days ago. I don't remember who it was. But it's a picture of Steve Austin in the late 90s at the peak of his popularity, obviously at a live WWE show somewhere. And CM Punk, I guess with his mom maybe, I don't know who else is in the picture, but a young CM Punk. And it's kind of interesting now looking back to see here's Steve Austin and a young CM Punk, and Punk idolized Austin. Austin now thinks Punk is maybe the greatest thing going on WWE television. And WWE would love to put the two of them together for a match. I'm sure Punk would love to have it at some point. But Punk wanted to be in WWE so badly It was his dream. It was his goal. And as Cabana said, when he got there, it didn't take very long for him to realize that what he thought was his dream was actually more of a nightmare than anything else. He was just held back by politics, people who didn't like the way he looked. There's a famous story about Tony Atlas was brought in to be a trainer or give advice, whatever his official position was, in, I believe it would have been OVW, back when OVW was still the primary developmental territory for WWE, and Punk was there. Punk was there for a while. And I think there was some sort of meeting. They got all the wrestlers together, probably in the gym. They're all standing there, not unlike what you would see on Tough Enough when they would get all the guys together and they would have a Rey Mysterio or a Bret Hart, you know, give advice and talk to them. And Tony Atlas singled out CM Punk. And he singled out the fact that Punk wears his wrist tape around his hands, up part of his arm. And apparently Tony Atlas didn't like this. And he made the remark, hey, well, what's wrong with you? Are your hands broken? And he made a comment that, you know, you'll never be on WWE television. And the funny thing was, at that point, Punk was already being featured on ECW. And I don't remember if Punk, I think Punk might have talked back to him and actually said that. Which, again, illustrates how much of WWE television Tony Atlas was watching at the time. But it's just, it's things like that, and Punk had a lot of adversity in that company that he had to overcome. And then the stigma of being, you know, the king of the indies, which I guess Triple H once called him backstage, and Punk was not happy about that. Just a lot of stuff like that. And then the brutal travel schedule. And a lot of what Punk talked about in his promo was also, shoot, in terms of the company not getting behind him fully, in terms of putting him on, you know, magazine covers, putting out a DVD of his matches, which I don't believe they've ever done, doing certain media appearances that he himself was never asked to do, or sometimes he'd have to fill in for somebody else, maybe higher up on the card, who didn't want to do a media appearance, and Punk would step in voluntarily and do it for them, and feeling like he never got credit for that. Punk, for example, is a 3-time former world heavyweight champion. And typically the way it works is when you are a champion and you make it to a certain level in WWE, you get to fly first class. And Punk was never afforded that opportunity. Punk still flies coach, whereas a lot of other guys would have been bumped up. And Punk may have been bumped up, but I think what happened is after he lost the title and kind of got moved down the card a little bit, I think what really bothered him was he got bumped right back down to coach. And it's not just that, but it's just a collection of all of those things. And Punk has become very disillusioned, as a lot of guys do with WWE. The travel could have a lot to do with it, the backstage politics. In Batista's case, he hates the PG direction. I mean, Batista has done interviews and cited that as the main reason you don't see him in WWE anymore. He says the Batista character is not tailor-made for PG. I'm not quite sure what that means. You know, it's not like, I don't remember Batista coming on TV every week, you know, for example, when he broke out of Evolution, using foul language and doing all these non-PG things. I think part of that is, he's just saying that, but he doesn't like the idea of being handcuffed to a PG product. Batista wants things to go back to the way they were in the Attitude Era, basically. And, everybody has their own reason. Has it lost its luster? It has lost its luster. It really has. I mean, I cannot remember a period, you know, that I've been following news stories like this. I mean, you know, even when I wasn't, you know, the internet wasn't around in the early to mid-90s to the degree it is now in terms of the online wrestling community. I don't know if there were many WWE guys in the early to mid-90s who worked for Vince McMahon, became disillusioned with the company, and left wrestling altogether to go do something else. I don't remember hearing stories like that to the degree that I'm hearing them now. You also have a lot of guys that left wrestling and they just left it completely. Muhammad Hassan. Obviously, he got pushed way too soon. He admits that now. You know, when he got that big push, when he was playing that character, I think he was 23 years old, got a lot of heat. As the character, you would imagine the character would generate a lot of heat, but got pushed way too quickly, way beyond his skill level. And there were a lot of politics that he had to deal with behind the scenes as well. And when they got rid of him from the company, he didn't go somewhere else. He left wrestling, and he hasn't looked back. And he's not the only one who's done that. And I can't remember a period in history where this many people have either left wrestling altogether because they said, fuck this, I don't want to deal with this anymore. WWE has so soured me on being a wrestler that I don't even want to do this anymore. I want to seek out a completely different profession. Or you have guys like Chavo and MVP who just cannot wait. They're salivating at the idea of getting out of their contract. It's like a, it's just an anchor that's tying them down. And they break free from the chains and they can go to Japan. They can go to TNA. They could take indie bookings. Some of them maybe have made a lot of money like Punk did. They don't have to worry about making money right now. They could quit their job tomorrow and be just fine and would probably be a lot happier. And you would think that the more we see people leaving the company almost voluntarily or wishing that they would get fired if they don't have the guts to quit on their own and just, you know, doing things in the hope that hopefully they'll fire me. I think Carlito was one of those guys, quite frankly. You would think that this would kind of set off some sirens in Vince McMahon's head, that maybe the way we do things here, maybe we should change that a little bit. We should be a little more mindful of what these guys want and take their suggestions. And I'm not saying kill PG because they're not going to do that, but you would think, and that has not happened. And unless you are a main event guy in WWE, if you are a main event guy, you will make such money that it makes a guy like Batista out to be, he's the exception, not the rule, because Batista was making a lot of money. And he lives a very, or at the time anyway, lived a very extravagant lifestyle. I mean, fuck, the guy traveled and up and down the roads and learned from Ric Flair, for crying out loud. And we've heard stories of Batista being a ladies' man and living large and all these different things. And even Batista, he said, I'm done, that's it. I'm going to go film some low-level budget B-movies. He opened up an MMA school or Muay Thai or whatever the hell it is in Florida. And he's perfectly content sitting on the sidelines. He says, you know, maybe one day I'll go back, but right now, I have no interest in going back. And I think that speaks volumes about the way that, that WWE operates now compared to even 10 years ago. It's just a very different work environment. And if you don't fit in there, or if you get heat, or whatever the case may be, you say the wrong thing, you step out of line, it could be a miserable place to work. I mean, how many announcers have we heard? JBL, Mick Foley, who were with the company for years. I mean, these guys were legends, former world champions, main event guys who make the transition over to the announce booth. And it doesn't last very long. I mean, I'm wondering how long Booker T is going to be doing it for. You know, when Foley and JBL, they both told stories, especially Foley when he left, of just being completely humiliated and harassed on headset by Vince McMahon, who just goes nuts on these guys. And everything has to be done a certain way. You have very little freedom to do what you want. Not everybody can go out there and cut a promo like CM Punk did. It's just not going to happen. If you think that this is the start of seeing more promos like that, you're wrong. And quite frankly, I don't want to see promos like that every week, because if we start seeing CM Punk promos every week like that, it's called Impact. It's not called Raw. And it loses, quite frankly, the impact that it had. But, you know, that's kind of the long way of answering your question. Has it lost some of its luster? You tell me. You read the same stories that I do. You see the same names that have left the company, that have been fired, that have quit. They go on Twitter and Facebook. They're so happy. And some of them, I think, it's just a front. And they're not as happy as they may want you to think they are. But in a lot of cases, it's 100% truth. These guys could not wait to get out of their contracts. And who would have thought that? You know, WWE, the number one, most popular, most recognized wrestling promotion in the country, if not the world. You make it work your whole life to get there, and you make it there, and you make it onto television. You're probably making decent money, and for some reason, you cannot wait to get out. Things must be so bad, these people just cannot wait to get out of that company. It's unbelievable. Kieran from England has two questions here. Number one, about WWE programming. Vince McMahon has stated before that the ideal show would be 90 minutes in length instead of 2 hours, but the problem is that the network does not have anything to fill that last half hour. And as you have suggested in the past, what might work is if they have a 30-minute show with interviews and comments from the superstars about rivalries, to give the matches some more juice. And anyway, his point is, do you think something like this would work in WWE? And as I mentioned to Kieran, I do think it would work if executed properly. Okay, that's the qualifier that I would put in that statement. That's the key. It has to be done right. So, for example, you know, I thought the original NXT concept had a lot of promise. I was very excited about it. And apparently they filmed a lot of footage with guys like Daniel Bryan and Wade Barrett of them training to kind of give us a better glimpse about who they are. You know, again, very similar to what UFC does with their countdown shows and HBO does with their boxing specials whenever there's a big fight. And WWE fucked it up. And because of that, nobody really pays any attention to NXT anymore. I don't get any emails about NXT. I don't watch it. I don't know what's going on. Part of that is it's not on TV anymore, but that says it all right there. The fact that the show isn't even on television anymore got bumped to the internet. And I think, quite frankly, WWE would be best suited to steal an idea from TNA of all places and have their own reaction-style show at 10:30. So if you have Raw go on the air at 9 o'clock, technically Raw ends at 10:30. And again, if it's still their TV time, so that, you know, Raw, kind of like Impact, could bleed over a couple of extra minutes, so maybe at 10:35 or 10:40. Whatever they call it, their version of reaction goes on the air, and it's done live. Maybe they have some pre-tape footage in there, but you know, it's the announcers and whoever, and not just Michael Cole. You have Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler at ringside. Maybe Scott Stanford or Josh Matthews backstage doing interviews. They're recapping the one or two key storylines from the show, and they use it also as a way to plug next week's show or the pay-per-view coming up that Sunday. But it has to be done in a realistic, kind of gritty type of way. I don't want to see a glorified free-for-all, which is what they still air the free-for-all before the pay-per-views. And free-for-all used to be live. It used to be even Sunday Night Heat. Look at the old Sunday Night Heat. Whenever there was a pay-per-view, Heat was essentially a pre-show for the pay-per-view. Okay, when UFC has these specials on Spike before a pay-per-view, they have a couple of preliminary fights, and they're hyping up the pay-per-view that night. It's not unlike that. If you can condense that into 30 minutes and make it kind of gritty enough. TNA did a great job on that with reaction, I have to say. I think that could work. I really do. And Kieran's second question was about WWE stars and specifically talent that usually, quote, performs on the show, the good in-ring workers. Who do I think has the ability to perform at a main event level? And also, do I think the current talent shown on Superstars will ever get off that show and be able to be seen on SmackDown or Raw on a weekly basis? Unfortunately, I think if you are one of these guys, like a Chris Masters, or Zack Ryder may be getting more TV time on Raw, but he's a unique exception because he's going above and beyond to try to get himself over. But if you're a Chris Masters or, you know, one of those guys, and you're stuck on Superstars every week, Chavo, you know, you'll make appearances on Raw and SmackDown here and there, but if you're on Superstars from week to week, you're pretty much stuck in purgatory. Unfortunately, that's just the reality of the situation. As far as somebody who I think has the potential to be a main eventer, you're going to laugh at me when I say this, and they've certainly beat him down enough and made you look at him as nothing more than a mid-card comedy character, but I think Yoshitatsu has main event level talent. I'm not saying that he could actually get over as a main eventer in WWE. Maybe he can, but I think the talent he has is such that he could be a main event level performer. I mean, like I said, can he be sustained as an actual main eventer and have people take him seriously in that position? That remains to be seen. But when he came over from Japan, he's a big star in Japan. Could have made a lot of money there, been a big star. He chose to forego all of that to come to the States and be in the WWE. He had a lot of promise back then. And, of course, WWE beat him down. And like I said, they turned him into nothing more than a mid-carder. Comes out to this wacky music, which I actually like. Although, again, if he's going to be a main eventer, he needs new music. But the fact is, you know, he's really good inside the ring. Like, really good. I mean, he's had some great matches on Superstars, but I don't think people have really seen the level of talent that he could really be. And he plays the babyface role just extremely well. And, again, I know it's impossible to conceive of such a thing because of the way he's been treated, but he's one of those guys that had, and I think still has, a lot of promise. It would take a lot of work to rehabilitate him. But Yoshitatsu would be one of those guys at the top of my list. Redneck Man writes in, if that is your real name, says, Dear Solomonster, how do they do the pyro for the wrestlers? I remember on a sound off a while ago, you mentioned that you were at Raw a couple of years ago. Well, 1998, it's more than a couple of years ago, and you saw them doing something with the pyro and said that looks like Shawn Michaels fireworks, and it turned out to be correct. It was the night that he returned to WWF. Is there a special way that they do it? Love the show. I am very addicted, and I am part of the triple threat. Keep up the good work. All I meant by that was anybody who watched Shawn Michaels when he was the champion, for example, and he was on Raw every week in 1996 and into 97, when he would come out, before he came out, they would set up, I think, three what I call launchers for the fireworks in the ring. And the setup was always the same. There was one in the left corner, one in the center, and one in the right. Not in the middle of the ring, but up kind of against the ropes on the far side of the ring. It was always the same setup. And so I saw that, and I immediately said, hey, I wonder if Shawn Michaels is coming out here tonight. And sure enough, he did. It's just the way they set it up. You know, Kane, for example, if you go back early on, go back even like a year or two before Kane came into WWE, you never saw those launchers taped to the ring posts. But when Kane would come out, and it was part of his character, you noticed that there were these things that were taped to each of the four corner ring posts. Well, it was because that was his pyro. He would come into the ring, raise his arms in the air, come down, and fire would explode out of each of the four corners of the ring. You would look at that and know, hey, that's set up to be pyro for Kane. I was going to give another example, but it's kind of a bad one. When Psycho Sid was in WWE, the very last time, I guess, for that last run he had in 96 into 97, he was a big baby face before he became a heel. He had his own pyro. They would lower it from the ceiling. And when Sid would get in the ring or would stand on the apron with his back turned and pose for the crowd, his pyro would lower. And the pyro made out the letters S-I-D. It actually spelled his name out. And when he would throw his arms in the air and pose, it would light up like sparklers. And the name Sid would be lit up in the air. And I say that's a bad example because, obviously, if they lowered the fucking thing and it said Sid, you knew exactly who was coming out. You don't have to have an IQ of 75 plus to know that. But it's just the way that they set these things up. I mean, that's really all I meant by it. Got an email here from William, a young fan, actually, who, it's a story of how he became a wrestling fan. We were doing this for a while, and apparently he's going to be away from the internet, unable to access the internet and even listen to the show until next month. And he wanted me to email him if I actually read this on the air, so I figured I would. Been a fan since episode 163, so he's a newbie. Says that one night he was flipping channels, ended up on UPN. Remember UPN? Horrible network that was. I watched someone who I can vaguely look back and say that was Booker T. However, I only watched it for about 5 minutes. I watched WWE on and off ever since about 2005 or so, with some vivid memories such as the Orlando Jordan Chris Benoit rivalry. Well, that was kind of random. I watched Benoit beat him in 22 seconds. One time when Mark Henry and Kurt Angle beat the hell out of The Undertaker as well, the Chavo Ray I Quit match, and a replay from John Cena throwing Edge in the Long Island Sound. My fanhood really took off in 2007. I remember seeing these commercials the nights before Raw on USA for the return of some guy named Chris Jericho. Before this, I would say that I watched Raw or SmackDown about twice a month, so I knew enough of the stories. Ever since that 1 week that Jericho came back, I have made a vicious attempt, vicious he says, to watch every single Raw, not just because of Y2J, I just felt like getting more into the product. I must also say that I have looked up old-time stuff on YouTube and actually like the WWE of old, rather than the newer shows. Big surprise there. Even though I am only 13 years old, I am a heel kid who hates John Cena and Randy Orton. Well, I guess that's the cool thing, to hate John Cena and Randy Orton. I could think of some legitimate reasons to hate John Cena and Randy Orton, but hard to hate John Cena. Such a good guy. Anyway, thank you for sharing that story. I will be sure to email William and let him know to listen to this show whenever he gets internet access. Where must he be that he has no internet access? He's 13 years old. He's not overseas fighting for, with machine guns or anything. Could he possibly be? The Bermuda Triangle, maybe? Oh, yeah, I got it. Maybe it's Parts Unknown. That's where he is. Parts Unknown. Say hi to the Warrior for me. Mike Gallagher writes into the show, still having great fun listening to the Sound Off, follow you on Twitter, and a friend on Facebook as well. Fine man, Mr. Gallagher is. I was wondering how many times you can remember seeing the X sign used by a referee in a televised match. I can only think of two instances, one when Flair got hurt at WrestleMania, and in a Money in the Bank match, and possibly when John Morrison busted his nose on a ladder, although I can't recall seeing the sign used, but he did get rushed to the back. You might be thinking of his partner from M&M. if I'm referring to the same match, I think it was a tag team ladder match against the Hardys at maybe it was Armageddon 05 around then. It was Johnny Nitro and what the hell was his tag team partner's name? Joey Mercury. That's who it was. God, he got fucked up in that match. I think that might be the match you're referring to. As far as how many matches have I seen the X use, a lot more than that. I've seen the X used, and part of it, they started using it also in a work sense as part of some of the storyline injuries, but I believe it's still the sign they use whenever there's a legit injury as well. They've used it a whole bunch of times. I mean, I can't think of any one instance right now off the top of my head, but yes, they've used it a whole bunch of times. One time they didn't use it, but you mentioned Ric Flair getting hurt, and for whatever reason, this just popped into my head. Again, I found it on YouTube years ago, so I'm sure you can all find it. There was a match on Raw. I think it was a tag team match, and Shawn Michaels and Ric Flair. Probably this had to be around maybe 04, 05. And Shawn Michaels is in the ring, and he whips Ric Flair into the ropes. And God bless him, whether you think Flair should have retired years ago or not, this is one instance where I thought to myself, it's a shame he's still wrestling. Flair hit the ropes, and as he went to come off the ropes, he was not standing up straight, and his head kind of got caught under the rope, so when he went to run, his face just smacked the top rope. He thought he broke his nose. He just clutched his face immediately and just dove to the outside, and it was really embarrassing. Not as embarrassing, necessarily, as the time he tried to talk into a book. This really happened. This was when he was feuding with Mick Foley. He actually had a copy. I think it was of Foley's book. Unless it was his own book. But I'm pretty sure it was Foley's book. And he had the microphone in one hand, the book in the other. And he meant to put the book down on the mat and talk into the microphone. And instead, he put the microphone down and he started talking into the book. And within 2 seconds, I think he obviously realized what he was doing. And the camera kind of went off him for a second. And he reached down to pick up the microphone and just continued on with his promo. Still one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Derek from Missouri writes in, been listening since episode one. Wow. Longtime fan here. My question is about Triple H. He came back for the program with Undertaker at WrestleMania and then vanished as quick as the Undertaker does whenever he gets injured. Undertaker just vanishes like a ghost. We haven't seen him since. Is this because he is learning all of the behind-the-scenes stuff or nursing some sort of injury? Also, do you think they may bring Triple H back soon, since they seem to be losing wrestlers like CM Punk, Edge, and so on? From what I've heard and read, we may be seeing Triple H back on TV in the very near future. I don't know exactly when, but I think they recognize the need for another main event-level guy. And if he does come back, it's not going to be on a full-time basis like he was before. The reason Triple H has been off TV, he's all healed up from his injuries. Again, I remember hearing last year before he finally took time off that he was nursing some achy quads, which, again, he's had two surgically repaired quadricep muscles. You don't want to fuck with that. If it tears again, his career may well be over. And so they were kind of bothering him. He had a neck injury that could have been serious. I guess it wasn't. He had to go film two movies, so he took time off and just never came back. And he's had a long time off. He was off for over a year, came back for the program with Undertaker, had a hellacious match with him at WrestleMania, didn't get hurt, I don't believe, or came out of it with any injuries. Undertaker was obviously worse for wear, and Triple H has not been seen since the night after when he cut that promo after WrestleMania, and looked a lot worse on camera because of all the makeup than he actually was. But yeah, he's learning the tricks of the trade. He's taken on a lot of responsibilities backstage. He's trying to learn every facet of the company. He doesn't just want to be a one-trick pony. He's you know, tried to learn a lot about production. He's tried to learn a lot about marketing and merchandising and licensing. He's learning every aspect of the company possible, which I respect. You know, the fact that he's taking the time to learn everything, because one day, the day will come that he is in charge of that company. So he wants to be as prepared as he possibly can be. And you may remember many, many months ago, I think even before WrestleMania, they actually, I think, put out a press release about this. Triple H officially got a promotion, and he's basically Vince's right-hand man. You know, he works right under Vince McMahon now, so he's got a lot of stuff that he takes care of behind the scenes, and, you know, he's over 40 years old. I think he's 42, not getting any younger. He's not ever again going to wrestle a full-time schedule. Will he be back? Yes, he will be back. Eric from Los Angeles, California, listener since episode 22, writes in, I'm looking to buy some WWE DVDs. Are there any good ones that you would recommend? I'm hearing nothing but good stuff about this new very best of WCW Monday Nitro DVD set that they put out. So I would, based off that, I'd probably recommend you pick that up, unless you were not a fan of WCW. And I haven't bought a DVD in a while. I've got a big collection, but it's just I just kind of stopped somewhere along the way. But if you haven't seen either of the Ric Flair DVDs, there were two different three-disc Ric Flair sets they released. One is the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection, then there was another one, the Definitive Ric Flair Collection. If you are a real wrestling fan, you must see these DVDs. The stuff on there is a treasure trove of just awesome wrestling from years ago right up until some of the more recent stuff that Flair did in WWE. So definitely check those out. I enjoyed Pick Your Poison, which was the Jake the Snake Roberts DVD. Somewhat depressing when you, you know, hear Jake talk about his life and talk about the troubles and the demons that he's had. But he's very open about it. It's very fascinating, I think, more than anything else. And there's some good stuff on there, too. From WWE, there's a WCW match against Sting. I think it was the Coal Miner's Glove match. There's some stuff from Smoky Mountain. There's the classic angle where Jake took his Cobra, the King Cobra, which sank its teeth into Macho Man Randy Savage's arm. There's a lot of good stuff on there, so I would check that one out as well. And the Bret Hart DVD. Bret Hart had a three-disc DVD set many years ago as well. Got a lot of great stuff on there, so I'm sure I'm leaving some stuff out, but start with that, and I don't think you will be disappointed. Aaron writes in, "Dear Solomonster, I've been listening to The Sound Off for over a year and a half now, and I love the show. I'm just wondering, who do you think would have been a good WWF or WWE champion that never was a champion? My two would be the heel Rowdy Piper back in the 80s, because I think he was one of the biggest heels in the 80s, and everyone hated him. Also, Nails from WWF in 1992. Nails. He just scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. I think if he didn't go crazy and choke out Vince McMahon backstage, he could have been that good heel cartoon monster that they had in the early 90s that could have lost to a good babyface wrestler like Bret Hart. Thanks again for answering my question." I agree with you totally on the Roddy Piper bit. Piper as a heel in the mid-80s was, as a foil to Hulk Hogan, was incredible. Just incredible. You know, I mentioned at the top of the show, I played that audio from Chael Sonnen, the UFC fighter. And he's not the only fighter or wrestler that patterned themselves in many ways off of old school Roddy Piper stuff. And when you are copied, when your stuff is copied by tons of wrestlers one, two, three generations after your time, you know you're doing something right. And again, Hogan was the top guy. You know, he was a victim of timing more than anything else. And I don't think Piper would complain, because Piper kind of, if Piper didn't have a big-time babyface like Hogan to play off of, I don't know that Piper would have become as big a star as he did in WWF. The two just kind of fed off one another. But I agree, Piper would be a fine choice, and quite frankly, I respectfully disagree, I think it's safe to say, with your comment about Nails. True, Nails was a very intimidating guy if you were a kid. You know, when he would do those promos, I didn't know that they were in the production truck speeding up the audio to make him sound that way. My dumbass self actually thought that this guy sounded the way that he sounded. He was a scary dude. He beat the shit out of the Big Boss Man. I remember reading the WWF magazine. They put these pictures in there of the Boss Man with all these bruises on his body. Just really, you know, scary stuff. But did I ever look at Nails as WWF championship material? Of course not. I would put Ted DiBiase in that other spot. You know, the Million Dollar Man who almost had a run, technically. You know, when Andre, quote, sold the title to him back in 88 when he beat Hogan on the main event, they let DiBiase wrestle several house shows as the champion before Jack Tunney made his official ruling that you can't sell the belt to another guy, and he just basically made the title vacant and never acknowledged that DiBiase was champion. But DiBiase was, as a heel, when he first came into WWF, much like Piper when he first came in. In fact, I would argue that DiBiase took the mantle from Piper once Piper went babyface in 87. Find me a better heel at that time in WWF than Ted DiBiase. Which is kind of funny, because DiBiase, some would say his best work came as a babyface in the old Mid-South territory, where he may well have been champion. I don't really remember off the top of my head, but even when he came into WWF, if his matches weren't as good as they were back in the Mid-South days, he was still a fine wrestler. He played the role to perfection. And quite frankly, had things gone differently in 88, and they would have put the title on him, if he would have beaten Randy Savage in the finals of that tournament at WrestleMania 4, I mean, who knows how different things would have been. You know, we wouldn't have gotten that awesome year-long storyline with the Mega Powers and all that. I think DiBiase would have done very well as the heel champion that the babyface chases. Even with Savage as champion, I mean, the house show business that he and DiBiase did when Hogan went off to leave and film his movie, I think he was filming No Holds Barred at the time, they did tremendous business together. I mean, DiBiase was hot as a heel. And I think he got screwed, you know, out of not having a world title run. But again, he was a victim of timing. The timing just, he was a victim of timing, and I guess the fact that Honky Tonk Man did not want to drop the Intercontinental title to Randy Savage. But anyway, that's a different story for a different day. Luis from Illinois, do you think Randy Orton is pseudo-position? What does that even mean? Pseudo-auditioning. He's either auditioning or he isn't. To be The Rock's opponent at WrestleMania 29 with his recent radio comments. Nope. I think he really believes what he said. He's, like I said, good friends with John Cena. And Cena gets a lot of flack and a lot of crap from a lot of people. And he was sticking up for his buddy. And he really feels the way that he feels about The Rock. I don't think he's auditioning for anything. Miguel writes into the show, Dear Solemn Monster, I was just wondering if I could get a shout-out on the sound-off of the birth of my third child. He was born on July 8th, which happens to be my wedding anniversary. Congratulations. He doesn't give the name of the child. I think you forgot the most important part. I can't give a shout-out to your kid if I don't know the kid's name, but I'll give you a shout-out. Congratulations. He said he's been a fan of the show. He has, not his kid, since episode 140 or so. He's also listened to all of the episodes available on iTunes. By the way, I am a part of the Solemn Monsters Triple Threat, Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. Also, this coming Saturday, July 16th, local promotion here in Puerto Rico called the WWC, it's the World Wrestling Council, will be holding their equivalent of WrestleMania. Anyway, this promotion is owned by the father of Carlito and Primo, Carlos Colon. One of the main events is Abyss vs. Carlito for the Universal title. Chavo Guerrero will be there as well. Mickey James will be. Just wondering if I can upload some pictures on your Facebook page so others can enjoy them as well. Well, you have my permission. I don't want any spamming of photos on my Facebook page, but feel free to post some of them. Brandon Mobley from Iowa Park, Texas, a listener since episode 145, although apparently not a member of the Triple Threat since he didn't mention it. I just purchased a copy of WWE's The Very Best of WCW Monday Nitro and was wondering, do you think 10 to 15 years down the road, we may see WWE Home Video producing the very best of TNA Impact? Well, I would say no. I don't think WWE generally releases DVDs of only 45 minutes in length, so I don't see that happening. John from Northern Ireland writes in, been a listener since December of 07, so that was the second month of my run here with the sound off. What was your most embarrassing moment as a wrestling fan? Mine was probably when myself and my family were watching TV just last year. We were watching Have I Got News For You, which is a popular show here in the UK and Ireland, and they began discussing Linda McMahon's Senate run. They even showed what I assume was one of the commercials you poor people were subjected to hourly in the US of Stephanie slapping Linda on SmackDown a few years back. They didn't say anything overly negative about wrestling, but my parents were giving me some sort of, is this what you find entertaining look? Well, actually, you know, that thing where Stephanie slapped Linda, I thought that was actually very effective back then. I mean, if I thought back to all of the moments of WWE television that embarrassed the shit out of me, that would not be on my list. I can't pick the one moment, but I've got a whole bunch. I mean, when Vince made Trish Stratus get down on all fours and bark like a dog, that was embarrassing. And there was actually somebody who's not typically a wrestling fan who happened to be watching this in the same room as me that night, and I was just completely ashamed to be a wrestling fan. It was just completely embarrassing. And I think any time Vince McMahon pulled his pants down to have somebody kiss his ass, we saw William Regal do it. We saw Jim Ross have his head shoved into one of his butt cheeks. He tried to turn away from it, but he still kissed his ass. He made Shawn Michaels kiss his ass. But you know, that just blows my mind. Anytime I think about that, when Shawn and Vince had their feud, and they were building to a match at WrestleMania 22, and Vince threatened to have Shawn Michaels join the Vince McMahon Kiss My Ass Club, I thought to myself, there's no way that's going to happen. They'll tease it, maybe he'll come close, he'll pull his pants down, Shawn will give him a low blow or something, but no. Shawn Michaels actually kissed Vince McMahon's ass. I still cannot believe, that he agreed to that. And if there's ever an illustration that anybody needs of the difference between Shawn Michaels in 1997 or the Shawn Michaels in 2007, Go back and take a look at that segment, because I cannot envision a scenario back when Shawn Michaels had the attitude that he had in the late 90s where he would ever agree to anything like that. And quite frankly, I don't blame him. I mean, if he would have refused it, I would have supported him 100%. I still can't believe he subjected himself to that. That was pretty embarrassing. Katie Vick may be at the top of my list. I don't see any redeeming entertainment value in that segment at all. In fact, the only funny part about the whole thing is when Triple H tells the story now about producing that whole segment, how they were filming it in a real funeral home, and he claims that there was an actual service going on right next door. And I guess when he was screwing the corpse of Katie Vick, somebody from the funeral home had to actually, duck in and either, you know, tell them to pipe down or find out what's going on, because Vince was producing Triple H and told him to really go at it. And you could tell when Triple H tells the story, even he can't believe he did that. But I could, you know, anybody who watches that, I have no way of justifying it. You know, you can really tell if a segment is truly embarrassing by whether or not you have a way to defend it. You know, there's certain things that they will do that might be questionable, that push certain boundaries, but you can find an excuse for it. Well, it's being done because you see these two are feuding, and this person did this to this guy, so it only makes sense that they're doing this, or whatever the case may be. And then there come segments like Katie Vick where you have absolutely no way to defend it at all. Zero. You know, the Dr. Heine skit where Vince made fun of Jim Ross when he was having surgery and thought he had cancer. Yeah, that wasn't entertaining at all. That was pretty low. The whole Eddie's in Hell thing on SmackDown with Ray and Randy Orton, who, you know, didn't want to do it, but didn't have the balls to refuse to do it. They did it anyway. All of those things are just some examples of moments that really made me ashamed to be a fan of wrestling. So anyway, that's going to do it for the mailbag. I want to give a quick shout-out to one of our listeners, Woodrow Fletcher. He's the one who actually tipped me off. I forgot to give him credit before, about that video. You can go to daddydoyle.com, which I think will just redirect you to the guy's YouTube channel, and check out that video of the Bret Hart incident from Raw with the NBA faces transposed and all the important figures. I guarantee that you will be entertained in some way by that video. So, he led me to the link, so I want to give him credit for that. If you have any questions, comments, or the like, you can email me at thesolomonster, all one word, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolomonster. There's a lot of photos I've been uploading, videos and such, and exclusive content, but you got to friend me on there and become a member. We are quickly approaching 1,000 friends on Facebook. I'm still a ways off, but if you friend me on there, you get other people to friend me on there. We'll get to that goal a lot quicker. And I think when I get to 1,000, maybe I'll post something special on there. So get on there if you're not already on there. Twitter.com/Solomonster. I post every bit as much, if not more so, on Twitter than I do on Facebook. So follow me on there as well. And, of course, you can subscribe to the podcast for free in iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. It should come right up. You subscribe, and the episodes get delivered to you automatically. You may have seen in the emails there that some people were referencing this triple threat thing, and no, they're not talking about Shane Douglas and Bam Bam Bigelow and all that from the old ECW, but if you are a follower on Twitter, a friend on Facebook, and a subscriber on iTunes, you are officially part of the triple threat here for this show, and if you email me in the future, be sure to mention that, and I will mention that on the air. Don't forget to also check out the latest SE Scoops mailbag on the main page. If you scroll down a little bit, I posted it up on Friday with the headline. I think the headline is, "Why is everybody suddenly hating on The Rock?" Seems to be a hot topic. A lot of comments in the comments section. Big debate there right now. Over 60 comments and counting. So you may have to weed through some of the trolls there, unfortunately. But some good stuff. So check that out. Be right back here next weekend with episode 168. So again, thanks for listening. Be well, stay safe. If you're watching Destination X, do enjoy the show and send in some feedback. Until then, take care, brush your hair. Have a good one, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.